Is Prom from the Royal Albert Hall with the BBC Philharmonic, conducted by Stephen Bell. And as we heard, the very first prom with a live animal on stage, Salty the Dog with Bernard Cribbins from Old Jack's Boat. And we also heard Katie from I Can Cook, Chris from Show Me Show Me, Jem from Swashbuckle, Andy from Andy's Dinosaur Adventures, Mr. Bloom and Robert the Robot. And if you'd like to actually see the concert, it'll be broadcast on CBeebies television over the August bank holiday. Well, with the BBC Philharmonic now on their way back to Salford, their seats will be filled on stage this afternoon by the musicians of the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, rehearsing for tonight's prom. Ravel's Valse Noble et Sentimentale and La Valse, the first performance of a new piece by Simon Holt, Morpheus Wakes, and then in the second half, it's a performance of Duroflay's Requiem. That's tonight's prom, starting at 7:30.
Glasgow, 2014.
So a first Commonwealth gold medal. This is going to be gold, another gold.
The home nation is pretty much in a line as they come in towards the home straight.
Get all the action, including later today, the men's 5,000 metre final.
This is our time to be able to share it with our teammates and look at them going mad down there.
The Commonwealth Games, online, on TV and on BBC Radio.
Now, just gone 12 o'clock and time here on BBC Radio 3 for Private Passions. Michael Barclay's guest is the actress Phyllla Delore.
Phyllla Delore burst onto the stage in the mid-1950s, and since then her career has spanned everything from the first British production of The Crucible to musicals like La Cage aux Folles and television, including Dixon of Dock Green and the wonderful Rumpole. Not to mention a list of films as long as your arm, The Time Machine and The Winter Guest being just two. Alongside all that, she somehow managed to fit in bringing up her two highly successful daughters, Emma and Sophie Thompson, both of whom have, of course, followed in her footsteps. Recently, she's turned her hand to writing and has produced a moving and funny memoir of the years she spent looking after her mother and mother-in-law in their old age. Phyllida, actually, mothers feature quite strongly in your life. In fact, you've played mother to both your daughters in films, like
That's
Emma
true.
And The Winter Guest and Sophie and Jane Austen's Emma.
Yes, hugely enjoyable.
Is there ever a problem when you're kind of working and you know somebody terribly intimately like that?
Everybody worries about that. That's the most question I've ever been asked. Is it difficult? And it isn't, because so much red tape has been cut. You know they don't take sugar in their tea. You know when they're nervous. You know when they're upset. You just feel it. And if supposing you've got a daughter cast, you have to take them out to dinner, don't you? You have to talk to them. You have to discuss what shape their nose is or what colour their eyes, so that you look as if you belong. I loved it.
And I suppose, that, as you say, there's a kind of shorthand, too.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
You can cut to the chase.
Mm-hmm.
I was interested to see that you quoted Quentin Crewe
in
your book. He said, "I don't think it's right to be proud of one's children, but I think you must be just a little pleased with their career."
Pleased is a different word. I'm Scots, so pride is a wicked sin. And B, why I had this allergic reaction to proud is that it's generally somebody who's just seen a performance, and I've just seen the performance. That's my colleague on stage. Wonderful performance. It's nothing to do with me. So to say you're proud is kind of self-regarding. I brought this thing into the world. Doesn't work for me.
The first music you've got is a wonderful three-part invention by Bach. Mm-hmm. And I think what's very important for you is not just the music, but also the player.
Glenn Gould. Well, he's extraordinary. I mean, sometimes he hums when he's playing. It sounds like something's wrong with the plumbing. In this one in particular, it doesn't do much, bless his heart, because it's so simple. I love it. Just the three notes, or is it four? I can't remember now.
It's got a little arpeggio.
Oh,
in the bass,
I love
it.
And it's very Musically, I don't understand why just moving from one note to another makes me cry. I don't know why. Just switches you on.
What's fascinating about that, I find, that performance, is that you can completely change the character of the music depending on how you play the left hand. So he does it quite staccato, doesn't he? But if you played it very legato, you would get a very different feel to it. On the other hand, that music was written probably with the harpsichord in mind initially, so he was right to have a certain separation.
Oh, how interesting. Never occurred to me. He's thinking, that's what I love about it. It's just as if he's sat down to think a few things through.
But he's quite happy to defy convention when he wants to. So he's not by any means a sort of early music purist or an authentic obsessive. obsessive in
an
other ways.
Authentic obsessive. Glenn Gould does a tiny hum towards the end, but very little on this, isn't it?
Bach's three-part invention, number 5 in E-flat, played by Glenn Gould. Phillida, lots of actors have a burning ambition to perform from an early age, but I think as a child you rather wanted to be a doctor. So what sparked that desire?
Well, I thought I was going to die young from a sexually transmitted disease. I was about 11. My friend Isabel Hebblethwaite, she thought I'd caught it from a loo seat, so I was weeding her sink when I went to stay.
But in fact, you were clear.
Yeah, well, gradually, over the years, it became so dreadful, the whole idea, that I had to admit to my mother that I was dying of a sexually transmitted disease. She told me I wasn't. And I didn't have to be a doctor anymore, so I just flew. and I could just do what I wanted.
So how did the transition from medicine to the stage come about?
I'd done a lot of drawing at home, and I liked designing things, and I thought I would do a technical thing and learn to be a stage designer. And I did, in fact, get a wonderful, wonderful contract when I was leaving theatre school to be a scenic painter, assistant in the wardrobe, and play as cast. So I had a wonderful time.
That must have been quite reassuring to have a kind of family around you, because you had quite a difficult wartime childhood.
What an evacuee.
Father left the family, and you were not a very happy evacuee.
Well, it depended where I was. I got moved about a bit. And finally I was, because I lived in a schoolroom lined with books, which is the only place to be, really, a room lined with books. And that was all right, the wonderful teacher. I think I was all right, really. I don't know, I can't compare it to anything else.
When you were at the Old Vic and you were designing costumes for ballet, actually, weren't
you? Yes, it was.
Yeah. Was that a visiting company?
No, my digs were a ballet school and they had a small ballet company, so I started designing for them.
And that's what introduced you to this next music.
Oh, so exciting. The Kavalevsky. It's extraordinary, you never hear of him nowadays. It's like Kachaturian, there's a K at the beginning, you don't hear it. But they lived just recently, didn't they? I mean, Kavalevsky till the 1980s, I think.
I met Kavalevsky.
You didn't?
In Moscow, yes.
What was he like?
He was actually rather a nice, gentle and patrician.
A little person.
He wasn't nice. Yes, yes. But, I mean, the trouble was it was in the presence of an absolutely appalling man called Tikhon Krenikov, who actually had pursued people like Shostakovich and Prokofiev on behalf of Stalin. So he was a pretty ominous creature, I have to say.
Oh, how fascinating.
And against him, Kavalevsky seemed very... very mellow and gentle, yes.
It was just that I was always on the stage and sort of, I ran it, if you see what I mean, if there was a performance. So in the Kavalevsky, it was generally off a vinyl record on a panatrope, they called it in those days, and I would mark where I came in for the music with a piece of tailor's chalk. It's different now, isn't it?
Yes, yes. And what do you like about this particular opening of the Comedian Suite? Does it remind you of getting ready?
Well, I just used to love that particular bit of dance that they did on stage, and I had dyed their costumes in a tin bath on the stove and they looked gorgeous. I was so excited about when it started, because there was a lot to follow, that I always left the house lights on. I could never remember to do anything correctly. It was my favourite bit of dance, really, on stage. Beautiful to watch. Very young people going mad.
We'll be right back. Gallop, and before that, Prologue, the opening movements of Kabalevsky's Comedian's Suite. Vasily Sinyaysky was conducting the BBC Philharmonic Orchestra. It's very much theatre music, isn't it?
Oh, there? Yes, and they must have had a lovely time in the orchestra, mustn't they? I love the boom. I think we used to call it the hot cavotte, that bit. I don't know why.
After you left the Bristol Old Vic for Liddell, the theatre school there, did you have any kind of plan for your career?
No, I'm curiously lacking in ambition. I just got a job at the London Old Vic walking on, which was wonderful, really, because I had never seen Shakespeare in that depth before. There were Claire Bloom and Peter Finch and all sorts of luminaries there. And with Romeo and Juliet, of course, masses of fun, really, being a Montague or a Capulet, whichever.
And, perhaps even more exciting, you met your husband, Ryan.
Yes, he was a Capulet and I was a Montague. It was a disaster. No, yes, I did.
Eric Thompson, he was actor, director and also Magic Roundabout creator, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. That was lovely.
So did you have a very happy marriage? I rather think you did.
Oh, what a lovely question. Yes, I think we were rather good at it. We seemed to get on. And we had these two extraordinary daughters, yes, and he... I don't think it was precisely normal towards the end because he was very ill for a long while, about 12 years, really. And I think that makes you too careful, if you see what I mean. You're trying to keep it all balanced. I think that's hard for your children, perhaps. I don't really know, but I suspect he might tell you a thing or three.
Mm. And he died in 1982?
Oh, how clever of you to know. I've forgotten.
Well, you have to know your lines, I have to know mine. This next piece of Schubert is perhaps rather appropriate at this stage, because that was obviously a very sad stage in your life. And there is a kind of love story behind this piece, too.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. In the last year of his life, Schubert, he dedicated this to his pupil, Carolina Esterházy, with whom he was in love, and I'm afraid, unrequited love.
Oh, dear.
And because it's written for four hands, we can, as we listen to it, imagine him longing to play it with her.
Oh, that's lovely.
Thank you.
Radulupu and Murray Pariah in the opening of the great Schubert Fantasia in F minor for four hands. It's great fun to play that, actually.
Is it?
Yes.
Because you cross over.
Yes, and there's a sort of give and take of the tune, you know. It's probably like when you're on stage working with somebody who you really love having a dialogue with.
You know? You're safe with.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's got great grace, hasn't it?
Do you find, I think this happens in music, that the more confidence you have with something you're doing and with the other actors, the more you're able to play with space and timing?
Yes. I was thinking about it the other day. Sometimes when you're very nervous or you're expecting imminent disaster, there are certain actors you just think, oh, it's all right, I'll be with him, he'll know. Whatever went wrong, that person there is so plugged in that it'll be fine. And that gives you tremendous ease, I think.
And also when you're, I think this is true in music, that when you're confident, and true of composers actually, and I guess writers, that if you can leave that extraordinary space between words.
Oh, yes.
They speak absolutely so much more loudly.
Absolutely, not enough of that.
Mm. Music clearly has a very emotional effect on you. Do you ever use it if you're preparing for a role or to get into a right frame of mind, or do you use it because you need some emotional prop at a certain point? You know?
I think probably I need it to recover.
What kind of music do you like to recover to?
Well, that would be fine, the Schubert. It's got complete simplicity and grace. That would be lovely.
Now, this next piece of music was inspired by a tour of South America.
Yes.
And it's a place that clearly had a big impact on you, didn't it?
Well, imagine the excitement of going round South America when you knew nothing about it starting. So you're going like Brighton, Mexico City, Quito, Caracas, Sao Paulo, Montevideo, Rio de Janeiro. That's so exciting, isn't it?
And you were taking Shakespeare?
I'm afraid so.
No, don't apologise for it. And Ralph Richardson.
Ralph Richardson and his wife.
Yeah.
Yes. It was Merchant of Venice and Midsummer Night's Dream. Can't imagine what they made of it.
Well, that was in the Allende days, wasn't it?
Ah, yes. And that's when I discovered, in fact, for the first... I remember where I was standing, on which pavement, when I realised that governments are terrified of music. Because I collected records in each country, because you can get that into a suitcase without too much bother. And I had a recording of a man called Victor Jara, who belonged, or maybe started, a group called the Inti Illimani, which we loved. And Victor Jara had a wonderful voice. And, of course, when the coup came and Allende was done for, Victor was taken to the stadium. His hands were broken because he was a guitarist, and he was killed. His two daughters went to the same school in London as mine did. They were away for 10 years from Chile. Now it's all right. But, you know, you just thought it's extraordinary that they should kill him.
Well, that fear of music is interesting. We mentioned Stalin earlier.
Yes.
And in a way, it's the greatest tribute you can pay to music, I suppose, is that people fear it because of its ability to evoke strong emotion in people.
Yes, extraordinary.
The music that you've chosen is from an orchestra that we've all found very inspiring here in the West, I think.
I know. Well, it's not a generally known fact, but I dance a lot by myself in the sitting room. Mm-hmm. The tango moves me to deep passion. I love it. And so a lot in South America. And I suppose I could tango to this, but this was extraordinary. I mean, to think that was pretty well played in a car park or something. I wish we could do the same.
And isn't it a wonderful story about this orchestra, which others have now copied, the Simon Bolivar Symphony Orchestra, which takes young people with social problems and has trained them into wonderful musicians, thus transforming their lives.
Oh, an extraordinary story. It's just very uplifting.
Well, this is Danse On.
I know, I may have to get up and move about.
Thank you.
Danzón No. 2 for orchestra by the Mexican composer Arturo Márquez, performed by the Simón Bolívar Youth Orchestra of Venezuela, conducted by Gustavo Dudamel. And you can find details of all Philip Doyle's music choices on the Private Passions page of the Radio 3 website. Well, that certainly got you moving.
Oh, it's wonderful. I'd love to have seen them play. I didn't.
You've written moving memoirs of your mother and your mother-in-law, now brought together in one book called Three Mothers and a Camel.
Yes.
It just explain this rather wonderful title.
Well, there's a list of questions they ask you if they think you might be a bit demented. They're generally quite ordinary, like count backwards in sevens from 100. I've been learning that, so I'm not caught out.
To cheat them?
Yes. But then you get rather more severe and they ask you really irritating questions. I'm appalled. How many camels, Michael, are there in Holland? What is your reply?
I've yet to encounter one.
OK, you might manage. How long is a necktie? How heavy is a standard hammer? I mean, all very male questions, which make me bitter.
These sound as though they're drawn up by people who are slightly demented themselves.
I quite agree.
Or an ironmonger. Yes.
Quite agree, yes.
Your mother-in-law lived with you for 17 years,
she
didn't
did.
She? Not a prospect many would relish, it has to be said.
It's odd about in-laws, isn't it?
But you had a very close and loving relationship.
Well, 17 years, and she was a Catherine Cookson character. She had a whole world behind her, which was fascinating. I like lunchtime because she'd tell you lovely stories about her mother going on benders with the gin and her going round to the pub for the jug. I mean, it's Dickensian in a way, and all the tales she would tell.
And you managed, I think, to find a lot of humour in the frustration of looking after her.
Well, yes. I mean, anything you said was generally... People like to be polite, so they'll say, yes, they have understood what you've asked, but they haven't really. So very odd things occurred. Weren't at all proper.
Can you give me an example?
Oh, well, there was the garlic situation. That was bad. Michael, I don't think you can...
Let's try it.
OK. She got very upset one night at supper because we were all staring at her and laughing. And she thought we were sending her up, and it was very hurtful. I was merely telling the story of how I had put garlic up my bum because I had hemorrhoids, which I can't spell, so I'll just say piles. And I forgot to sort that out before I left early morning with the car and Granny to drive home to London from Scotland. So round about the Midlands, I had to let fly. And she thought there was something wrong with the car. I said, no, no, we're just driving through a lot of agricultural country. We got round it that way, but I had to tell the family, and the explosions of mirth, of course. Disgraceful.
I didn't know that was such a good remedy.
No, it's quite helpful.
Right. I will have to bear that in mind in the future.
Yes.
Most people, actually, it's a serious point here, most people find it quite difficult to view old age in the rather healthy way that I think you do. I mean, do you think we've rather got it wrong as a society?
Well, I think we've been frightened, don't you? Pay no attention, it's ridiculous. And you are allowed to forget things are going to the wrong room, for goodness sake.
As I mentioned earlier, Phillida, you've had to deal with quite a lot of sadness in your life, problems of old age and dementia, and the early deaths of your husband and brother, actually. Mm. And do you find that music helps when things get tough in those sort of situations? Because we all find, don't we, when we go to memorial services or funerals, that music is unbearably moving, but it is cathartic.
Yes, it's unbearably. I think you sometimes avoid it because you know that that will split your heart and you will collapse. You can choose music, of course, that diverts you from what you're thinking about, can't you?
Well, like Dance On, number
yes, two. Like Dance On. Put that on. Oh, I do. I do sometimes put things on because, well, to move is terribly useful.
This piece we're going to hear now, I think you heard Britten and Piers perform live. And this is an extraordinary haunting piece. It's the dirge from the Serenade for Tenor, Horn and Strings. And it brings us to an interesting question, which I think you've thought about quite a bit, which is that very often composers slightly destroy poetry and kind of recreate it in their own image.
Don't like poetry set to music, don't like it, really.
But this is different.
But this is different. It's actually called a dirge, isn't it? Mm. And it's so the language, the whinny, a whinny to an Englishman is a horse laughing, isn't it? Mm. The whinnies will prick you to their bare bane. It's so evil. I love it.
Fire the monster dust, and Christ is in us.
stays with you forever, doesn't it?
I love the way he just has the turbulent strings to start off with and keeps the horn back until that entry, which just knocks one out of one's chair.
Absolutely extraordinary. It was Dennis Brain originally, wasn't it? I wanted so much to learn the French horn.
Yes, it's quite a difficult instrument.
I'm sure.
Of all the brass instruments.
Is it?
Yes,
really?
It's the most difficult. And in the same way that the oboe is the most difficult of the woodwind.
Oh, really? Mm. Oh, really?
Well, you're quite right. That was written with that wonderful horn player, Dennis Brain, in mind. He was sadly killed in a car accident when he was very young, returning from the Edinburgh Festival. It was written in 1943 and uses selection of six poems by British poets on the subject of night, including both its calm and its sinister aspects. And the Lyke Wake, which we heard, the Lyke Wake Dirge, is an anonymous 15th century poem. Most extraordinary. But there we heard Britten himself conducting the London Symphony Orchestra strings in the dirge from his serenade for tenor, horn and strings with Peter Peers and the horn player, as you said, not...
No, Barry Tucker, wasn't
yes,
it?
Yes, that's right, it was Barry Tucker.
But I mean, oh, I don't know what I mean. I think it's wonderful.
It's a very powerful piece.
It's the way he scoops it up, Peter Peers. Mm. It's fantastic.
The glissando.
Yes! Extraordinary breath control. Mm. I saw them both once performing, which is a great pleasure to recall, because they so enjoyed it. I remember that the encore was, if you want any more, you can sing it yourself. They were both so nice.
The next piece of music is by the Malinese singer Salif Keita. And he's had a pretty difficult life, despite being related to the royal family, because he's albino, and that's a terrible taboo, I gather, in Malinese society.
I can imagine.
He is a wonderful musician, but I believe that it was your grandson, Tindy,
yes,
who inspired you to choose this piece.
Well, I didn't know anything about this sort of music at all, did I? And Tindy was adopted by my eldest daughter, when he was a little lad, not all that, 16, I suppose, now he's 27. And it's just he's just got a different music in his soul, really, being brought up with various things, and his joyous and his rhythms are wonderful to behold.
He had been, I think, a forced child soldier in
yes,
Rwanda before
yes,
Emma Thompson and Greg Wise adopted
yes.
him.
Yes, yes, that's right.
And then I think when he comes to visit, he announces his arrival, doesn't he, by shouting...
He shouted through the letterbox, "Ancient lady, I'm hungry."
Well, here is Tekere by Salif Keita.
That would make Tindy dance.
Banadi moju ya bankila fumo kake na juya.
Yeah,
Tekere, applauded by the Malinese singer-songwriter Salif Keita.
Tekere means applaud. You are clever, I didn't know that. Oh!
So you learn something new every day.
That's wonderful.
You've been in many films and television dramas, Phyllida Law, and of course, music is often a very important part of them. It tells you whether to be happy or to be sad or to be fearful. You very seldom hear the music when you're on the set.
I know. So upsetting, because it's just, it's what makes it somehow.
But your final choice of music comes from a film where the music was played
heard
on the set.
Most extraordinarily and always and movingly, because it was in the Austrian Alps. It was a film called Lecture 21 by a young and very dishy director, Alessandro Baricco, who really believes in Beethoven. So obviously he needed it on set as much as we did. I was playing a character who controlled the wind, which is quite funny because I can't control mine. But Alessandro did get the sound deck in the middle of a field of snow, sitting there. Wonderful. Made all the difference.
You wrote about this rather beautifully in your book, and I wondered whether you'd like just to read that passage for us.
Yes, I'd love to. Walking back to base on a snow-encrusted path, late in the evening it was, I think, I heard what I thought was the wind using the trees as a tuning fork. I stopped to listen, and the sound grew and shifted, touched the trees and lifted, sweeping behind me. Turning, I saw that the sound man was sitting at his desk in the middle of a snowfield, playing the third movement of Beethoven's quartet 1-3-2. It hung in the air like the aurora borealis.
There is something quite extraordinary about that music. I see exactly what you mean about tuning forks or and that sound you get from wires in the air.
And when you were outside, extraordinary.
And actually wonderfully played there by the Takash Quartet. That was the movement, Holy Song of Thanksgiving, from Beethoven's Quartet in A Minor, Opus 132. And I felt they played it with the kind of reverential, almost as though they were holding it at arm's length because it was so sacred.
Yes.
And they do that with Bartok, that they play marvellously well.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh, I think it's very moving.
So Beethoven's String Quartet, Opus 132, to finish. That's not a bad piece of music to choose for your final.
Glorious, isn't it? It's awfully sad, isn't it?
It's very sad.
It catches you right.
Well, thank you very much, Phila de Lor, for sharing that and all the other pieces with us.
I've had a lovely time, thank you.
Private Passions was presented by Michael Barclay and produced by Jane Greenwood. It was a Loftus production for BBC Radio 3. And details of all Phila de Lor's music choices are on the Private Passions page of the Radio 3 website, from where you can also download the programme.
Good afternoon, a warm welcome.
Well, next
to
week,
Doug and
at the same time, Michael's guest is the psychoanalyst Stephen Gross.
Their intimate side. We're going to hear C.P.E. Bach's Sonata.
This summer,
by Rachel Podger and
dipped into the
Zachary
BBC
Orman,
proms.
Best known as
Cole Porter
will be showing off his skill as a violinist, playing duets with
Jimmy New Howe,
and we'll end our season with Ian Botham.
To write
marry me, marry me, marry me.
A good tune,
Kiss Me Kate,
Kiss Me Kate comes to the BBC Proms. John Wilson and his orchestra perform Kiss Me Kate next Saturday evening at 7:30 here on BBC Radio 3.
BBC Proms. Hear every note played on BBC Radio 3.
This is BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and online. It's 1 o'clock and this is David Cornett with a summary of the news. The Palestinian militant group Hamas has agreed a new 24-hour humanitarian truce in Gaza. A spokesman said the decision was taken to coincide with preparation for the end of the holy month of Ramadan and in response to UN mediation. There's been no word from Israel so far. Earlier today, Israel ended its own brief ceasefire in response to rocket fire from Gaza. A team of 30 Dutch forensic experts have cancelled a visit to the crash site of the Malaysian airliner, which came down in eastern Ukraine 10 days ago. The team is in Ukraine, but says fighting between pro-Russia separatists and government troops in the area is preventing access to the site. The shipwrecked cruise liner, the Costa Concordia, has been towed into the port of Genoa, where it'll be scrapped. The vessel had been towed from the island of Giglio, where it capsized after hitting rocks 2.5 years ago. The Labour leader, Ed Miliband, says he would introduce a new question time in Parliament, allowing members of the public to question the Prime Minister. The event would be held at least once a fortnight, if allowed by the Commons. A spokesman for David Cameron said the Prime Minister was open to new ways of engaging with the public. Passengers arriving at Gatwick Airport have been facing delays of up to 5 hours to reclaim their luggage. Some have been told to go home without their cases and wait for them to be sent later. Gatwick blamed staff shortages, but said operations had started returning to normal. The Philippines is officially marking the birth of the country's 100 millionth baby. Officials identified 100 babies born about the same time in state hospitals as a symbol of the 100 millionth Filipino. They were given gifts of cake, clothing and blankets to mark the occasion. And the weather. There'll be showers in the north. It'll be brighter later with localised thundery showers. It'll be mainly dry with sunny spells in the south, but isolated thundery showers are possible in the far southeast. BBC News and Weather at 1:02. And now we have another chance to hear last Monday's lunchtime chamber prom, which was recorded at Cadogan Hall in London. It's presented by Petroc Trelawney.
Good afternoon. A warm welcome to Cadogan Hall, where for the next 8 weeks, the BBC Proms show off their intimate side. We're going to hear C.P.E. Bach's sonatas, played by Rachel Podger and friends. Zachary Oramo, best known as chief conductor of the BBC Symphony Orchestra, will be showing off his skill as a violinist, playing duets with Janine Jansen. And we'll end our season with Ian Bostridge and Dame Felicity Palmer narrating William Walton's Facade. We mark several Proms anniversaries as well. Mezzo-soprano Alice Coote and Michael Collins's London Winds perform Richard Strauss's music 150 years after his birth. This year also marks the 250th anniversary of the death of Jean-Philippe Rameau, which is where we start our season. One of the great heroes of French music, Rameau was a pioneering figure in the world of opera who collaborated with Voltaire, enjoyed patronage from the wealthy and royal family, and shocked and delighted audiences in equal measure with his stage works. Today, the only chamber music that Rameau wrote, played by a quartet of musicians drawn from that great French period ensemble formed by the urbane American William Christie, Les Arts Florissants. They're going to perform Rameau's Pièce de Clavecin en concert, 16 short pieces divided into five works, dances, character pieces, and a series of wonderfully witty portraits of friends, colleagues, and patrons. The harpsichord takes the leading role. Rameau was relaxed about his other instruments, though today we follow his instructions with violin, viola da gamba, and flute. A little later, we'll hear more about the works from harpsichordist and director Paolo Zanzu. For now, please welcome him and his colleagues, violin player Florence Malgoire, Emmanuel Balsa, who plays viola da gamba, and flautist Charles Eble, Les Arts Florissants. Thank you.